Did you know the average couple waits 6 years to get help in their marriage?
Yeah, that's 6 years of pain, hurt, and frustration.
Hi there, I'm Charlotte Snow.
And I'm Robert Snow.
And welcome to Master Your Marriage,
where we believe that having an amazing marriage should never feel like hard work and shouldn't be a guessing game.
This is the show for married couples who want to discover a scientifically proven approach to building a masterful marriage and have fun while doing it.
So if that's you, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
In last week's episode, we kicked off our secure relationship series by diving into why secure partnerships are absolutely crucial in our chaotic world. Because let's face it, our world is kind of crazy. It's always been full of threats, from everyday stressors to bigger uncertainties.
Yeah.
The outside world is not always going to feel safe, but our relationships can and should. In a secure relationship, we can find that real sense of peace and safety and stability. The flip side, however, if we're living in insecure relationships, it usually leads to poorer mental, physical, and emotional health, shorter lifespans, and just being stuck in this kind of constant state of heightened anxiety. So in the last episode, we laid out three foundational signs of a secure, functioning relationship.
Let's talk about those three signs.
Let's review those three signs.
Okay. So the three signs of a secure, functioning relationship are: one, our relationship must always be a place of safety and security. Always allies, never adversaries. Two, parity. We're equal shareholders with shared power in every domain of our relationship. That means equal say in finances, parenting, chores, just about everything. When there's an imbalance of power, it almost always breeds resentment and bad behavior. And number three, we prioritize our relationship over everything else. Now, in part two of this series, we're going to explore how our brains are wired to create our very own attachment style.
Our very own attachment style.
Which may be similar to someone else's, but it's still our very own.
So here's the thing I think we don't really think about very often, and that's that most of what we do in life, probably more than 90% of what we do, is on autopilot. Almost all behavior, almost all of our habits are unconscious. We just sort of go about our day acting and reacting without really thinking about it. And this includes how we relate to our partner, how we move toward them, how we move away from them. You know, back when we were in a shiny, brand new relationship, it might have been a little bit different. We might have been a little bit more mindful and intentional about how we were showing up in the relationship.
Oh, because we're in love.
Right? That love without knowledge phase. But once we sort of solidify the relationship and things are looking permanent, that's when we really slip into our automatic patterns. And that is when our attachment tendencies really start to show up. And often for couples, that's when the friction also shows up.
So there are three relationship attachment styles. One is secure attachment. The other one is avoidant attachment. And then the last would be anxious attachment. But before we jump in, let's talk about labels real quickly, because they can be a double-edged sword. On the positive side, understanding your attachment style or your attachment tendency can be a game changer. When you recognize your own patterns and your partner's, it deepens your empathy and makes it easier to team up and to work through challenges together. It can even help you be more forgiving and more supportive. Like, okay, I understand why she pulls away sometimes. It's actually not all about me. Likewise, we can use that understanding to self-course correct, saying like, hey, we're doing that thing again where we have this pattern, whatever that is. And I'd love for us to be able to get back on track. So knowledge can be really powerful when it's used with compassion.
Yeah, but the danger of kind of understanding attachment styles, as I see it, is that labels in general can totally go wrong if we're not careful. We might use labels to otherize someone, other people.
I like the otherize. Okay? Yeah.
We can use labels to blame people. We can use labels to devalue people. We can use labels as ammunition when we're in an argument. Like, oh, there you go again, Mr. Avoidant, never taking responsibility. There you are again. You know, so as we share this information with you, remember never to weaponize these labels against each other. Instead, think of attachment styles kind of like just variations in normal human behavior. I think most of us have some level of insecure attachment. Most people don't have secure attachment these days. So think of this as like normal variations, not a flaw or a defect in your partner. We're all wired a bit differently, and that's totally okay.
Well, that's all built differently.
And that's what makes us human.
Yeah, some have attached earlobes, some have detached earlobes. And much like that, our attachment styles also vary. And that's normal. It's not abnormal at all.
Definitely keeps life interesting and not boring.
Yeah, without a doubt. One caveat, while most people lean towards one of these three styles, not everyone fits neatly into a box, and that's totally fine. Some people have a blend, like a mix of avoidant and anxious traits, and it can even shift depending on the situation or the relationship. So don't force yourself or your partner into one specific category. Just use this information as a tool navigating whatever is coming up in your relationship. And I want to add a caveat. As you listen to us talk about these different attachment styles, I think the first and most important thing to do is identify which attachment style you relate to most and avoid the trying to put your partner into their attachment style. I think it's more important to let them find out what their attachment style is, because I think it would be easy in this situation to say, oh, that's totally you over
there. I'm secure. You, on the other hand,
these are all the things that are wrong with you.
You're so anxious.
And in the world of self-reflection and relationships helping us grow, looking in the mirror and identifying your attachment style and figuring out a way to soften out the hills and valleys is going to be the best thing for your relationship.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, so where to begin?
Yeah.
I think where we begin is talking about kind of what shaped our attachment styles. What we do know for sure is that our wiring, however it is that we're wired, that wiring started very, very early in our life. It's shaped by our childhoods. It's shaped by how our parents or our caregivers responded to us early in childhood. Yeah. So I want to spend a little time here unpacking and maybe giving some examples of how our relationship style gets formed. I'll share some personal examples on that. And so let's start out with attachment theory. So in attachment theory, there's something called your primary attachment figure. And your primary attachment figure is that go-to person that you rely on most for safety and security when you are at your most vulnerable. So when you're a baby, that may be mom, although it also could be dad. It also could be whoever it is that's stepping in as that main caregiver. It's that person who is providing the most consistent care, the comforting, the soothing, the protection. So maybe one way to think about it is throughout life, you've likely had one person different at different times in your life, but you've likely had one person that you would run to when you were distressed, when you were scared, when you were most vulnerable, and also when you were bursting with excitement with some kind of news to share. And in childhood, you probably know which parent that was. And then in adulthood, hopefully that becomes our romantic partner, because even in adulthood, we're still wired to seek that same kind of connection.
Yeah, I was thinking about who it was I ran to, but I grew up in a single parent household. So
yeah, you didn't
unfortunately,
have a lot of
choices. My mom had to straddle a lot of boundaries with being the compassionate one as well as the authoritarian figure.
So for me on that topic, it actually was my grandfather, because my grandparents lived next door. And because my parents had so much chaos going on, my safety, my protection, my security came from my grandparents next door, primarily my grandfather.
Isn't it so awesome though that you had that?
Yeah.
Amazing. But what we need to know is from the early time as we develop a sense of security or insecurity based on how our caregivers show up for us. And here's the key. You don't have to have gone through this great big massive trauma to end up feeling insecure as a child. Sometimes it's the subtle things that are done often that really shape who we are, shape our styles. We're going to read a list of questions, and I want you to take a moment to reflect on your own childhood and just see if you feel like any of these maybe are partially true or totally true when it comes to your childhood. So number one, I was left to play alone or really fend for myself.
Number two, was I treated like a show item and trotted out for praise or attention and then kind of put away when I wasn't needed anymore?
Number three, was I expected to meet my caregiver's needs more often than they met mine?
Number four, did I have to manage my parents' self-esteem or their emotional ups and downs? I know I did.
Yeah, I did as well. Number five, was I pressured into staying young, independent, and not allowed to grow up even at my own pace?
Number six, the flip side of that, maybe I was forced to grow up too fast and become super self-sufficient early on.
Number seven, were my parents so overwhelmed with their own issues that I had to, quote, not be a problem for them?
Mm-hmm. Number eight, were they sensitive and responsive to my needs, or did I feel like I was always guessing?
And number nine, Did I feel like my emotions were validated, or were they dismissed and maybe minimized?
Did I have someone I could turn to when I was sad or feeling vulnerable?
Was there consistency in how they showed affection and support, or was it somewhat unpredictable?
So depending on how you answer these questions, you might start to recognize that maybe I didn't have the most secure attachment growing up.
Yeah, without a doubt. Now, there's an important distinction here. This has nothing to do with whether or not your parents actually loved you. Love and security can coexist with gaps. Two things can be true at the same time. Your parents might have loved you, but still may have not been equipped to provide that rock-solid sense of safety and security that you needed growing up. Maybe they were dealing with a lot of their own stressors at the time, and maybe they're not equipped at all, and that spilled over into how they showed up for you.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll share a personal story about this from my own childhood. So I have four older siblings and two younger siblings. I was kind of in the middle, but the first four were really close in age, and then there was a big gap before me. And the oldest, he actually got into drugs as a teenager, and he kind of put my parents through the ringer. At one point, he actually almost died from a drug overdose and needed to have life-saving open heart surgery. Around that same time, the other brother that was a little bit younger than him, he was in a terrible motorcycle accident where he was hit by a truck. And he ended up in a body cast, immobile for months and months and months. And so there was a lot of stress going on in our house. And my mom was not very well resourced for all that stress. And you also have to kind of know going into that there was some generational stuff also happening. My mom was only 19 when she started having kids. Her mom was only 15. So we're not talking about handing down great resources.
No.
And a lot of maturity.
But even with the most mature individual, that is a lot going on.
That's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And then there was my sister, who is in the middle of these boys, and she was the good child.
Rock of Gibraltar.
She never gave my parents any grief. She always got lots of accolades for being so low maintenance. Even when I was growing up, it was like, oh, you should be like your sister because she was like so good.
Yeah.
And on the surface, that sounds kind of cool, right? To be known for being so good and so easy. But if you think about it beneath all of that, what is the message? The message is, thank goodness you are easy and don't have needs, because you know what? If you had needs on top of all this other stuff, I don't think I could handle that. I don't think I could handle any more problems. So thank goodness you don't have any of those needs. And if she knew that kind of growing up, how could she ever feel like she could turn to someone when she was sad, when she needed support, when she had needs? As you look at her, and I love her, she's like one of my favorite people in the whole world. She still manages too much for other people.
Yeah, without a doubt. But that's how she grew up.
And she doesn't really get to speak her needs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes our parents or caregivers just can't provide that safe home base that we need in our to feel safe. And it's not always about a lack of love. It could be their own physical or mental limitations, unresolved traumas, immaturity, or just life circumstances that are really hard in Charlotte's mom's case. The point is, it still impacts how we are wired as we're growing up and how we later relate to others in our adult relationships.
Yeah, I just thought of something. I had a friend one time whose mom, when she was little, grew up with MS. Obviously, her mom loved her, like loved her. But the message when a parent has an illness, a severe illness like that, the child may not feel like they have their needs met. So it's not about love.
Yeah.
It's not about love.
Without a doubt.
But when a child has a truly secure home base, what does that look like? Well, it looks like the parents who are prioritizing and protecting and nurturing that child above other things, okay? If the parents tend to value other things more than the child, like, say, appearances or performance, the child's performance, that's a big one, or their intelligence or talents or money or the family reputation. That's another big one I see. Like people in our family, we don't do these things. If those things become more important than the safety and security of the child, then the child often grows up feeling insecure. And conversely, a secure setup, parents are going to be focused on, and they're going to be attentive and they're going to be attuned to the child's needs. And because ruptures happen in every relationship, they will repair those ruptures and those hurt feelings really quickly. And the parents are going to model self-regulation, and they're equipped to be able to manage their own emotions and impulses without creating chaos in the family.
I feel like me, mm-hmm. and you're listening to all this and saying, man, what would have been like to grow up? What would have been like to grow up and all that? I just want to let you know you're not alone.
Well,
and I wonder, and I ask myself, how many families are actually really doing that? Because I didn't know too many that were that way.
Less than half.
I did know a few. So it's less than half.
Less than half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, let's change that.
Can we do better?
Yeah.
Let's try to do better.
Oh my gosh. When you look at children who grew up in these securely attached homes, what do you see? Well, they tend to handle their own emotions quite well. They handle their impulses better because honestly, their amygdala, which is the brain's alarm system, isn't constantly firing warning messages. They're not on high alert. Securely attached children are generally more empathetic. They have stronger moral judgment. They are more resilient to anything that comes to them in their world. And they're able to explore their world with confidence, knowing, and not just understanding, but knowing that they have a safe base to return to.
Yeah, I think that's such a big thing. When children feel secure, they feel safe. Like, I can go and learn how to drive a car, or I can take these risks, or I can do these things because I can feel confident in exploring the world because I can always come back home.
Yeah, always have this safe
and
base.
And just have the safe place to come back to. Yeah. But like Robert just said, neither of us had that experience. Some of us have rotating caregivers, or we have parents who were inconsistent or distant or overwhelmed or had their own healthcare issues. Whatever the case is, though, it does wire us in ways. It wires our brains for how we show up later in life. The good news is, if all of this sounds really depressing,
there's some good news. Trust us.
There is good news in recognizing it. Recognizing where we're at is super powerful. It helps us so that we can start to build a more secure pattern now in our current family, which makes our children have a higher chance of having secure relationships in their adult lives.
And that's one of the things that we really want. We want to be better parents, better lovers, better marriage, so we can model a secure relationship for our children.
100%.
Okay. Let's dive quickly into each one of these three attachment styles and how they show up in our relationships. We'll start with secure, since we covered a lot about that last week, but it's worth a recap.
Yeah.
The secure attachment style. The standout feature is that couples really see themselves as in each other's care. They're interdependent, which means they can express their own needs while also leaning on and supporting one another. They are equal shareholders in their relationship, and they also protect the relationship from those not so great impulses that we all have. If you missed that last episode, definitely go back, give it a listen, and then maybe come back to this point. To get a sense if you and your partner lean towards secure, here's a quick checklist. See how you respond to the following questions. Number one, I'm fine by myself, but I really enjoy the give and take of an intimate relationship.
Number two, my close relationship feels solid and not fragile. It can handle ups and downs.
Number three, lots of physical contact and affection. It's totally fine with me and it feels natural.
Four, I am equally relaxed whether I'm with my partner or whether I'm alone. I think that one is really telling.
Yeah. I can share my needs and my feelings openly without worrying that it will blow up.
Disagreements don't shake the foundation. We talk it out and we move forward.
I generally see my partner in a positive light and assume their intentions are always good.
All right. So those statements might give you an idea whether you and your partner lean toward secure. The next relationship style is avoidant. So we're going to talk about avoidant. I will tell you up front that my style of relating when we got into our relationship tended to be more avoidant. I think a good way to explain avoidant, I'll just share a story with you. And this is a couple story, but it isn't actually a real couple. It's a composite of several couples that I've worked with, and I've just sort of blended their stories together. So meet Stephen and Angela. They've been together for 7 years. And when they first met, Stephen pursued Angela with so much intensity. But about 6 months into their relationship, things shifted. Stephen, all of a sudden, like almost felt like overnight, he dialed back that intensity and he dialed back affection and connection.
He won the race.
He won the race.
He won the race.
And that drive to win the race actually ended up getting replaced by, well, now what do I want? And it started to replace, he started to replace it with his hobbies, his friends. You know, he would head out to play tennis and not even consider inviting her to come along, even though she liked to play tennis. His house was under construction at one point, and so they decided to move in together at Angela's house. So they were living together. But then once the renovations were done, now the conversations about merging their lives more permanently started to come up, and he just dodged that. And when Angela tried to talk about, hey, let's come up with a shared goals or shared visions for our future, he would sidestep that conversation. And probably the most painful part was that she felt at that point, that's when physical touch just disappeared from the relationship. And the only time she would ever be touched was during sex. And so she was starving for any kind of intimacy or closeness. And now, before you get mad at Stephen, which would be really easy to do, you have to remember.
It sounds like he's not very nice of a person right now.
But he wasn't setting out to sabotage his relationship on purpose. You have to remember that he was just operating on autopilot. This is just doing what it was that felt natural to him based on his wiring. And he'd been that way for a really long time. And really, in his mind, any reasonable person would think like him and act like him and do things like him. Like, he didn't understand why anyone would need any more physical touch. And so when Angela would ask for more physical touch, he just called her needy. So he really just couldn't see it, because this is how he was wired. He couldn't really see it any other way.
Yeah. I mean, growing up, this was his base operating system.
Correct.
This was just the way it was wired into him. And he didn't have a primary attachment figure to turn to for emotional support and soothing. Instead, he had vivid memories of his father's disapproval and constant emphasis on performance. Since he only received rare physical affection as a child, he learned to not really seek it or even need it. In fact, he learned not to count on people too much for anything at all.
So I'll tell you what my life motto was as a kid, and you'll see why I was avoidant.
Oh, what was your life motto?
I can do it myself. I don't need anybody.
I remember that. Yep.
I don't need anybody. I don't need people. I can take care of it myself.
Why do you think that you had that?
Well, this is how I was wired. I learned to depend on myself. I learned to meet my own needs. I learned not to rely on too many other people to get those needs met. And if it was going to be, it was up to me.
Because there was a lot of turmoil when you were small and growing up, right?
With your
two brothers. At the very least. And
so, of course, I felt like that was a virtue. That felt very normal to me, to feel like I could be an independent, autonomous person. And depending on someone would feel like weakness. If I had to depend on someone, that would feel risky and scary to me, because what if they let me down?
And when they did let you down.
Because they had let me down.
Yeah.
So people with avoidant tendencies, kind of as I just described, they can mix up what that independence and autonomy really means. It can get kind of confused in our mind. And just much like Stephen, he would have viewed himself, like me, as a highly successful, very self-reliant individual. And we would look at those things as being these virtues. But in reality, those were adaptive strategies that our younger selves, him and me, like, had to come up with in order to deal with maybe neglect or not being able to rely on someone for some reason when we were children. So our younger self had to adapt to a certain set of conditions. And that's what wired us to be very independent. But the truth is, that's not real autonomy. That's a coping strategy.
Yeah. You weren't allowed to be vulnerable.
Right. No, absolutely, that would be scary.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's review a quick checklist to see if your partner and you might lean towards avoidant. How many of the following sort of ring true with you? All right, number one, I know how to take care of myself better than anyone else could.
That's me.
That's you. I recharge best on my own, in my own private space, away from everyone.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm upset, I need time alone, not with my partner, but I need time alone to cool off.
Mm-hmm.
Number four, I often sense my partner wanting or needing more from me than I'm really comfortable giving.
Because it might be vulnerable.
Number five, I'm most at ease when no one else is around, sort of demanding my attention.
Maybe not so much that one, but the rest of these definitely me.
Number six, I'm low maintenance and look for the same in my partner. It sort of keeps things simple. Number seven, closeness can feel a bit smothering. Number eight, I downplay my emotions and prefer logic over any deep emotional talks. Is that you? Do you think that was you?
Early on.
Really?
I really like our deep emotional talks now, but for sure early on it was, you know, I think what was the one you said really resonated? I am low maintenance.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many times have you heard me brag about that in our marriage?
Without a doubt, you're low maintenance.
I don't need flowers. I don't need gifts. I don't need this. I don't need that. I'm low maintenance. I appreciate low maintenance people around me. I don't be high maintenance. Like that was definitely one of my traits as well. Yeah. All right. So that was avoidant. Did that resonate with you guys at all?
Resonated with you over there.
Yeah. Let's talk about anxious, Robert.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about more about Robert's style. What did Robert bring to the party?
So as you probably starting to realize, there was a combo in our relationship of anxious avoidant. But a great way to, I think, again, illustrate what an anxious attachment might look like, although Robert's manifested a little bit different. He can talk about that in a bit. But I'll share another couple story. Again, this is not a real couple. This is a composite as well of several clients that I've worked with. But meet Mia and Jordan. All right. Mia and Jordan, they've been married for about 10 years. And from the start, Mia was drawn to Jordan because he was steady and he was reliable and he felt like the anchor she never had. As time went on in their relationship, what happened with Mia is her fears started to bubble up in their relationship. If Jordan's the husband, if Jordan didn't respond to her text, if he didn't call her back right away because maybe he was in a meeting or he was running errands, she would start to spiral pretty quickly. And she would be worrying, imagining the worst, maybe an accident, or maybe he was pulling away. And she'd start to blow up his phone with messages like, hey, is everything okay? And that would lead to, why aren't you answering me? And that would lead to, hey, what's going on? Why did I do something wrong? And by the time he replied, she would be really spiraled up. And she might even be accusing him at that point that you just don't care about me. You don't care enough about our relationship. And Mia found herself also kind of worrying about all the worst case scenarios. She'd check through his social media feeds, scroll through his likes, through his comments, sort of looking for any sign of disinterest, or sort of any sign of threat. And at home, she couldn't really relax either. She would do a lot of fault finding and nitpicking over small things like how he loaded the dishwasher or how he forgot to mention something he had to do at lunchtime. And for Jordan, the husband, this was really overwhelming. He felt like he couldn't breathe without scrutiny. He felt like he was walking on eggshells all the time, tiptoeing around her mood, tiptoeing around her anxieties. And it wasn't that she was trying to push him away. It would be easy again to hate on Mia. But right. You have to remember, this isn't her intentionally trying to cause drama. This was her automatic way of relating. And in some way, in her eyes, this was how you show love to someone. This is how you show that you care. And so sometimes—
Sounds like she'd drive me crazy.
Because you were married to low maintenance.
Yeah, that's probably why. Yeah.
Right?
We can only have one anxious attachment person in the room.
So what were her parents like growing up? Why do you think Mia was like that?
Well, I mean— So let's talk about how her parents helped program her and help wire her.
Yeah.
Right. Her parents were loving, but probably a bit erratic. One day they'd be attentive. The next day they'd be distracted by their own stresses. And she learned early that love could go away if you weren't very careful. So she adapted by staying hyper alert, seeking constant reassurance that she was loved and that she was cared for from her parents. This preoccupied style often stems from these type of inconsistencies, leaving people, especially children, with deep-seated fear that their relationships are so fragile that they have to maintain constant vigilance and effort to keep them feeling safe.
So tell me about how that showed up for you. Your anxious, preoccupied style surfaced more like a fear of being abandoned.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we've talked about on the show, my mom was married 4 times. So I would always seek for maybe father figures or just even in relationships. And so I always just sort of had a feeling that they were going to end. This was in the back of my mind. So that we call this the abandonment issues that I dealt with.
But
so,
if we even go back further, it was like similar to Mia in that you had love, but it was erratic. It was there and it was gone. A father was there and then was gone. So it was that inconsistent.
Yeah. I mean, it even pile up on top of my mom having to fulfill both roles. Right, where she had to be the authoritarian figure and sometimes giving us love at times, but it would go away. And then, you know, trying to manage my mom's emotions as well. She wasn't great at that. So there was a lot of that back and forth, you know, worrying that she was going to leave and she'd be gone for weekends oftentimes.
Your anxious and preoccupied tendencies would show up as, what did you do? What was your kind of typical behavior?
Well, if you're going to be anxious attachment, your and especially for me with abandonment, then I would just be hyper attentive to people pleasing. Like I'd always want to make sure that I'm like, oh, you love me, and I'm doing things to make myself really valuable. You can't see yourself without me. And that's how it showed up in our relationship and also probably other relationships that I had.
So if you could make yourself valuable enough, then I would never leave.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to see your life without me,
right?
Which made me an amazing boyfriend. Flowers, very attentive, always checking in. We didn't have text messaging back then, so I couldn't text you 900 times. So.
But at some point, you start to placate. You start to put my needs before yours. You don't share your needs with me because if you have needs, I might leave. And now you just start becoming resentful.
Oh, absolutely.
As you're accommodating me, you're angry into the circle.
Yeah.
You're angry with me, like, you know, talking crap about me in your head, like, I can't believe her. And I'm over there just thinking you're a great husband and you love me. But the truth is, you're accommodating me to keep me, but you were doing so resentfully. So people with these anxious tendencies, like we just talked about, they can feel an amplified threat when there's any hint of distance, and they can be overly sensitive to any signs of rejection or abandonment or disconnection.
I would say they're always scanning for distance.
Distance, yeah.
You know, constantly just measuring and then, whoa, you're a little too far away.
Yeah.
Like, I want to close the gap.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So here's a checklist. If you see, this is for anxious attachment. If you see any of these statements, if they sort of fit you, maybe you have a little flavor of anxious attachment. Number one, I worry a lot that my partner might lose interest or leave me. Check. Definitely, Robert. Okay. In the past. Number two, if they're not responding quickly, I assume something's wrong with us. Number three, I need frequent reassurance that everything is okay in the relationship. Yeah, that felt like me. Number four, alone time feels uneasy. I prefer constant closeness or check-in. For some reason, I didn't have too much of that. Number five, I often feel like I'm giving more emotionally than I'm getting back. Yes. Number six, small conflicts blow up in my mind into bigger threats to our connection. Yeah, I think I felt that too.
Sometimes those still happen.
Yeah, sometimes they still happen. Yeah. Number seven, I'm quick to express frustrations and it's hard to soothe me once I'm upset. Because I think you can just get spun up, and that goes back to number six.
Mm-hmm.
Letting those small things just perseverate and run in your head. Number eight, past abandonments or inconsistencies make me extra vigilant now because, again, I'm worried about this attachment. Number nine, I often test my partner's commitment to feel secure. I don't think I did that much, but yeah. So I'm pulling like, seven out of nine on those. That seemed, I seem to recognize all those. And it's funny as I look back and I think, man, I did that. Sort of shaking my head. Cause now I don't like, and here's the thing. As you see that, as it's reflected back when I talked about earlier, you have to recognize that. And can you course correct? Can you try to become a little bit less in that? And I think we all have a blend of each of these.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a lot of secure attachment now, but once in a while, that anxious attachment still rears its head. But the beauty is in your relationship, if you both can get to this point where you're secure, the beauty is when those things come up, Charlotte looks at me and she's like, yep, I know this is his anxious attachment showing up. How do I soothe that? And how do I bring him back to the secure thing?
How do I help him to feel safe and secure?
Right. How do I help him to feel safe and secure?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that might be the antidote for anything that is other than secure attachment.
How do I help him feel safe and secure right now? This is sort of popping back up again. And what would be the worst thing to do? Oh, you're just overreacting, Robert.
Yeah.
How's that going to be helpful? That would not be helpful. So what could I say in that moment that would help you, or do in that moment that would help you to return back to knowing you're safe and secure?
Yeah. And I think we've managed that, especially with your avoidant. Like when you pull away, which is weird, you pull away because you're avoidant. I'm anxious. You're pulling away.
So you're chasing me and I'm pulling away more.
Instead, I think a couple of times I've just held you and I've said like, we're good. This is where we are. We're in a good place.
And that's you doing the same for me, which is helping me to feel, okay, I don't need to do that pattern. I can feel safe and secure right here, right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's bring this all back, because that's what Robert's doing right now. Like, let's bring this all back to why this even matters. Because if we're going to be developing this truly secure functioning relationship, remember the first thing we talked about last week is we have to always be allies, never adversaries. So that's what Robert's talking about. Like, what do I need to do right now to help him to feel safe and secure? What does he need to do? That's what an ally would do. And sometimes that can be challenging because our brains can be wired so differently. And so that leads us to the second core principle in this series. Last week, we did the first principle. This week, the core principle that we want to leave you with is to become an expert on one another.
Yeah.
Become an expert, because when you really understand how your partner's brain works, when you understand their attachment style and maybe what triggers that to come back out every once in a while, when you understand their needs, then you're so much more equipped to be able to navigate whatever challenges are coming up. If you're not an expert in your partner, then you're just going to be on autopilot. And if you're on autopilot, then you're going to react impulsively. I would say something to Robert like, oh, you're just being needy, or oh, you're just being overreactive, because that would be that impulse reaction. And what's that going to do? That's only going to create a greater sense of threat within the relationship, which is only going to create, again, more bad behavior.
So let's leave you with a few practical tips on ways to apply these principles we've talked about today. So number one, dive in deeper to becoming an expert on one another. What attachment style best describes your partner and which one fits you? Remember, as we said earlier, never use this as ammunition, only as a way to deepen your understanding and your compassion for your partner.
Number two, you strike a balance between accepting your partner and the way that they're wired and finding acceptance in yourself and how you're wired, but also temper that with responsibility. Hey, we're not saying you have to totally overhaul who you are. Your attachment style is likely going to be there on some level for the rest of your life, but you also can't shame someone. Our relationship, if it's going to be our safe place, we can't shame each other into changing. Safety in a relationship means that we are working to accept each other as we are, but at the same time, being willing to look at our impact on each other. Because we can't use our attachment style as an excuse for bad behavior. Instead, we can do our best to help to make one another feel safe and secure.
Yeah, absolutely. Number three, don't try to change your partner. Acceptance goes both ways. It's crucial for them as it is for you. No one shifts from insecure to secure under threats or under pressure. The only way someone is going to become more secure is through first acceptance, then respect, and then always, as Charlotte talked about, bringing them back to safety.
All right. Well, that is going to be a wrap for this week. Next week, we're going to dive into how you can build kind of a bubble around your relationship, an invisible force field around your relationship. And we're going to start to unpack more specific tactics on how you can build safety and security together.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a wrap for this episode. We hope that it really gives you some insights to contemplate this week. Be sure to subscribe to the show so that you don't miss the next one in the series. And if you're enjoying it, help us out. Leave a 5-star review and a rating for us. This really boosts the algorithm, kind of kicks it around a little bit for us, and gets our message out to more couples who may need this help in their relationship. And as always, if there's anyone in your life who you feel like might benefit from this episode or any of our episodes, please, please share that with them.
Remember, be kind to each other this week. Put each other first. It's the small things done often that create the biggest impact.
Until next time.
Thank you for listening to Master Your Marriage. If you have a topic you'd like us to cover, then we want to hear from you. Just go to MasterYourMarriagePodcast.com and send us your question.
Oh, and while you're there, you can also check out our retreats and events and even apply for coaching.
And make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you get advanced notice of when the next episode drops, plus show notes and many extras. Thanks again for tuning in.